Professor Towns is the Andrew Mellon Professor of African American Religion and Theology, and soon to be the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs as well at Yale Divinity School. She's also the President-elect of the American Academy of Religion. She holds undergraduate and graduate degrees from the University of Chicago and a PhD from Northwestern University. Professor Towns' teaching and research focus is on Christian ethics, womanist ethics, critical social theory, cultural theory and studies, as well as on postmodernism and social postmodernism. Among her many books are Womanist Justice, Womanist Hope, and In a Blaze of Glory, Womanist Spirituality as Social Witness. And she's here to speak to us today about her most recent book, Womanist Ethics and the Cultural Production of Evil. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here, finally. I had managed to forget why I couldn't be here the first time, because it was not a pleasant memory. I'm glad it's a beautiful day today. It's actually one of those crisp blue sky days. So it reminds me, I guess, a bit of why I started this project. Evil has been a concern of mine since childhood, and that's not unusual, I think, for black kids of my generation growing up in the South, and it was still the segregated South in many ways, because it just didn't make sense, the kinds of social codings and cultural codings we were being raised with, the kinds of segregations that were both good and bad, made it a mystery for me, being raised also within a church context. So hearing on one level that God loves everybody, and seeing on another level everybody doesn't love everybody, but somehow those folks were also lumped in with the Christians. And so having to sort of make sense of those, you expect things to line up when you're a child. And it's only older when you realize that human folly and humanity and inhumanity make that impossible. So evil's been a topic I've been interested in for quite some time. And when I finished my degree from Northwestern, I was sitting literally in a hot tub at a Society of Christian Ethics meeting, not going to a session, with Katie Cannon, who's also another noted ethicist. And I said to her, Kate, you know, I really want to do a book on evil, but I don't have enough to say. And she said, that's okay. Do an edited volume. And I thought, will people actually say yes if I ask? And she said, yeah, you just ask. So I did. And that was how A Troubling in My Soul, Womanist Perspectives on Evil and Suffering, became the book that it is and was, and continues to my delight to be used in classrooms. And the thing that I did not realize at the time is that none of us talked to each other, but each of us reconfigured the theodicy question, the question of why is there suffering in the world. That the question wasn't why God allows this. The question is, why do we do this to each other? And we didn't talk about each other. It just happened. And that's the way the book was, very organic in that way. And so it demonstrated to me, as I was starting to hear the comments about the book, that we do things differently, yet again, when we're in different cultural locations and different social locations. We see things differently, we hear things differently, we process things differently, we think theologically and morally differently. How do we put all that together in one big tent? So finally, years later, I discovered that I did have a book, that I had thought about evil long enough and hard enough that I was going to do this very quick study of evil that lasted 10 years. Mostly because I think it was the arrogance of youth at that time, but also I didn't take into account that the way sometimes even scholarly books will stop you if you're going down the wrong path. And if you're paying attention to your research and writing, and they will rewrite themselves, and you become a participant as opposed to always being the captain of the ship, or the mistress of the house in my case. So the book itself turned out very differently from what I had planned. I wasn't thinking of using stereotypes. I wasn't thinking of using an interplay between history and memory and the imagination, as I do in the book. But because I started to look, and the book really started to take wings, literally in the shadow of September 11th, 2001, when I was on sabbatical here at Harvard, and all that evil talk that was going on, had a profound effect on what I started to think about as I started to sit down and bring together all the things I'd been writing and researching on. So what happened was, for me, being brought up short, as I listened in horror people being demonized and therefore legitimized as good objects of terror, both within this country and outside of this country. Sometimes them was us and sometimes we were them. Was seeing that Christian ethicists have taken some time in trying to understand the nature of human inequalities. And we've written a good bit about it, and not much has changed. What are we missing? What are we missing? What's that ingredient that we haven't talked about much? And as I was looking outside my office one day, which was a great office because it looked out on the yard, so I had this expanse of green and trees that I could look at when I was working. And the answer was an intuitive one. It wasn't one that came from research and reason. It was the impact of the imagination. We'd never really taken seriously, I think, the ways in which our imaginations will hold things in place in ways that are so subconscious and are so difficult for us to get at that we don't even appreciate or realize it's being churned, because it becomes a sort of a piece of the natural fabric of who we are. So I started to, after that that intuitive moment, and I turned to Antonio Gramsci and Michel Foucault, who are, that's like a radical turn. But they helped me understand some things about the nature of hegemony and the nature of the fantastic and the nature of the imagination, not so much for what they did, but for what they weren't talking about. And so they became conversation partners for a couple months or so as I tried to understand what I was learning from them. And from that conversation with them and working through them and looking at the different ways that structures of evil play out first in black life and then in society writ large, I came to think about this piece of the imagination, which is not the piece that brings us to our best selves, is the fantastic hegemonic imagination. And then using literary theorists like Lipsitz, whose first name has just walked right out of my head, and the work they do in counter memory, to talk about the narratives that are not placed within the grand narrative of our lives. To use that as a counterpose to the ways that our imaginations create these stereotypes that we then think are true about each other, and the way they are then placed, or the way they can become a way to think about larger social issues like identity as property and commodity, empire and Christian triumphalism, unexamined ways in which religious thought gets wrapped up in our welfare policies and we act as though they're neutral when they're not. What I call uninterrogated coloredness, which is a way to sort of unhinge the conversation about race and racism so that it's not just talking about darker skinned people and the problems they encounter, but it includes whiteness in the equation and how we all are both inheritors and also agents for dismantling race and racism, because it's a very wholly inadequate category to begin with. And then to also talk then about what kinds of solidarity do we need to practice with each other in order to address these sorts of issues. And then finally, ending with an attempt to think through the kinds of ways that we as people of faith are also citizens in a republic. And how do we blend that in ways that we continue to do some sense of a separation of church and state, but also recognizing that it's kind of maybe a sort of facile distinction given how much is marked by Christian religiosity in our social institutions. So that is the book in grand scope. And one of the questions Eric asked me, which I'll sort of end with, is, you know, what does your work as a womanist ethicist and beginning with black women's lives, how does that become accessible? This is rewriting the question in a little bit.
In a much better way.
How does that become accessible for folks who are not black women? And my first response, which is one I always give, is I learn a lot from Reinhold Niebuhr and I'm not a white guy. It's the thought, it's the method, it's the theory, it's taking what people give you, which I think, I find very little of our thought is universal. But from the particular places in which we think through issues, and offering that as a conversation partner, which is something I didn't say, a conversation partner to start trying to understand each other. And the more we understand each other as genuine human beings as opposed to caricatures and stereotypes or assumptions, or as James Baldwin would say, not as social projects, but as flesh and blood, the better off we will be, I think, in getting us closer to a more just society, where love actually means more than simply trying to get us over until we can get to a place where there is a place of justice, where you combine love and justice to create perhaps some little peek into that new heaven, new earth. So that's the book, or for right now.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And so this gives us lots of time to dig in with the issues on any sort of angle that you you all would like to do. So the floor is now yours.
Yes. A lot of questions, actually.
That's okay.
I assigned this book for one of my classes last year.
Mm-hmm. And so we undergrad or grad?
Undergrad. Uh-huh. So we had to gloss over a lot because methodologically it's very complex.
Uh-huh.
But just in terms of the structure of the book, I was really, as a reader, pulled in by your use of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you'd talk about why you did that and what hope you had it with, what hopes you had it. That it would have on the readers.
And when you say my use of poetry, can you point to something in
particular? Yes, pages
150
to 158. I will not save the killers. Oh,
and that
you're,
one,
and
yeah.
You're responding to June Jordan's mm-hmm. text, and it, in some ways it doesn't make any sense if they haven't read the book.
Yeah.
Mm.
But it's really powerful because it makes it, it almost gives it an organic quality that just a strong argument in and of itself, while powerful on the brain, can't necessarily impact mm-hmm. on the heart. And so the poetry, I found a really useful move.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering why you did it. What people's responses have been to it?
I have been told by a lot of people, and I have now just accepted that they must be right because that many people probably see something that I don't recognize as poetry. That, now that I understand as poetry because it's written in that kind of verse style. that I have a somewhat poetic voice anyway in my work. And that started very consciously, actually, after I finished my dissertation, where I did the obese institute, the dense linear thoughts I could get done. And I realized the first time I had to do a public lecture after that, that I don't write that way in sermons. I write in free verse in sermons to break up some of the density of thought, but also for me to play more with ideas and images. What would happen if I wedded those two things together in my own work as an intellectual? And so that section in particular was first a lecture. It was a lecture. It wasn't a lecture. It was a panel response for Bev Harrison's retirement at Union Seminary in New York, in which the panel was on solidarity among women. And I sort of rolled my eyes. I was like, oh, Lord. Another panel on solidarity with women. We're gonna have, you know, either I'm gonna start a fight because I'm gonna go. I don't find a lot of it among black and white women. I don't see it branching out into Latinas and Asians and other racial and ethnic and nationalities. Or I can try and reconfigure the whole thing. And so, I decided to reconfigure to try and be constructive as opposed to just being cranky. And so it started out as a panel response. And I've come to learn that the way I now write, I start working on a book long before I realize I'm doing it. By the lectures I start taking on and the new topics I start exploring and how I get into it, sometimes oftentimes not with folks saying, you know, talk about what you want to, or the conference is about this. And so it starts churning. So that move was, in the book, was to let folks see often what they only hear when I'm doing a lecture. And to know that it becomes a little more challenging because you now have to really pay attention to the way I'm thinking, because you've got to try and follow the page. Why is this placed here? And we had long battles with the publisher about getting things placed correctly on the page. And why? No, you can't put it like a block. You have to move across the page like this. I know it causes the typesetter's headache, but you publish poetry. So you can do this. And I was like, oh, think of it as poetry. Yes, think of it as poetry. But I don't think of it as poetry. I think of it as a way for me to try and engage yet another way to think critically and analytically that becomes, tries to draw on ways where I'm not looking at the obvious way into something at first. I'm trying to find another way to sort of tilt my head and think about it. So the question in that chapter is, what happens if Topsy speaks? What happens if she's no longer the caricature that Harriet Beecher Stowe makes and makes her to be in Uncle Tom's Cabin? Well, what happens if she takes on flesh and blood and starts to, as we say in colloquially, move her neck, begins to talk about her life? What does it mean to objectify black children in this way? And then what does that mean for the rest of us? And then when we're talking about solidarity and differences, and not a sort of kumbaya thing where we all sit around a circle and, you know, the campfire's warm and glowing and we have really good interaction and then nothing happens after it. How do we think about this in a way that's a much more structural? That has a chance of, if I capture your imagination, you may take it somewhere and begin to use it for not only intellectual thought, but concrete social change, to think about it. So the use of poetry is one way to get at that, because it's not expected. I mean, if you're paying attention, you see it popping up in places of who I'm using. But I've heard more and more people who haven't sort of been watching what I do be sort of, oh, much your response. But the book before this one, Breaking the Fine Rein of Death, it begins with a sermonic fragment, which is in poetry, and ends with a sermonic fragment, which is poetry, and then launches into, in the front part of the book, a look at lament, and the book is framed as a lament. And then the back end of the book, looking at eschatology, but a realized eschatology. This one is sort of picking up on that, but you wait till the end to see it. Because I think it's sometimes when I'm asking folks to think with me, what would it mean to radically break from what we're used to? You have to make a radical break in print also, because it's easier to keep just going around along, going scanning like this, and sort of going on autopilot. But now you got to sort of follow. Your eyes have to follow the page and the ways in which I'm trying to take dips and turns and challenge myself as much as I'm challenging others.
I think, and I expect that we'll have time to come back for more of your questions, Megan. Are there other questions in the...
I have one that's sort of similar to Megan's, but so what you were talking about just now, Emily, was the sort of genre or combinations of genre that you can use in print to actually get people to react imaginatively to your work. So you're not just writing about the imagination, but you're engaging the imagination. And I found that really powerful in Breaking the Fine Rein of Death, because as a bioethicist and as a white person and an ethicist, I can understand the arguments, and those are convincing, but your book really sort of opened up a door into the experience that you were writing about that I wouldn't have been able, I mean, not that I really accessed it by reading your book, but, you know, it helped to see more than I would if I just read an argument that was straightforward, even though it might have been a convincing argument. And my question is, you know, the book is about this book is about the cultural production of evil, but it's also fascinating to think about the cultural subversion of evil, I guess, also through imagination, and which is what your books are doing too. And really, the question, like, how do people become aware of evil that is already enveloping them in their context? And their opening statement was a good example of what I wanted to hear you talk more about, because you said, as a black child growing up in my generation, many of us were aware that although we were told to love everyone and this was Christian, you could see that in fact a lot of people didn't love everyone, and we reacted against this because we knew it wasn't right. Okay, and if you look at, like, generations of just women, any women, growing up in patriarchal societies, by far the majority do not realize that this is not right until there's sort of a consciousness raising, you know. And so what do you think enables that critical insight from within sort of a cultural apparatus that's already got in place a different imagination?
You know, I get this question a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's a hard question if you're not used to doing the looking. And I keep trying to find the answer I think is the right answer, so I'm going to give you the current answer I have, because I don't think it's quite right yet. And I always invite people to think with me about this one. Because I was raised with a set of lenses that I'm not sure I know how to teach, but I can tell you how I was taught. And then maybe together we can think through how would we translate that today. The way I was taught, which is not true for a lot of black youth today, until fairly recently when things start to get so bad that you're like, okay, the civil rights movement maybe didn't do everything we thought it did. is that it was the older folks, not necessarily always adults, but the older people in the community who said, look, here's some things you need to know. So it is that sort of, that is that first definition in Walker's womanist, which is, we've got a responsibility to pass knowledge down and wisdom down and critical, the critical imagination down to the next generations. That's just a must. And so part of what I see, this book comes out of a class. The book didn't make the class. This book comes out of a class I'm currently teaching right now called The Political Economy of Misery. And one of the things that we started to get at yesterday in class, as we were finishing up a section on identity as property and commodity, and 9 students shape the class by asking 9 questions. And that becomes the class for the day, as we try to work through those questions. And I watched an interesting thing happen. Because the reading list is big, and to make it manageable and affordable, there are a couple of sections, and this was one, in which I gave them a menu of choices to talk about identity as property and commodity, and this time I decided to approach it through the lens of gender and sexual orientation and sex and sexism. So we looked at Patricia Hill Collins' Black Sexual Politics, D'Amelio and Friedman's Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America, and Janet Jacobson's and Anne Pellegrini's Love the Sin, which is a book on public why public policy formulations around tolerance and sexual ethics is not a good idea. And so I grouped the folks who are doing the sessions along the lines of each book, and just did it alphabetically the way it appeared in the syllabus. And it just so happened that the people who chose this book, who had also chose to lead the discussion, there were only 2 folks. And I watched this class unfolded where people were uncomfortable in engaging the 2 questions from these 2 Black women. But as the class went along, it was okay. There was more excitement about intimate matters and more excitement about Love the Sin. None of those books are easy books to read. But there was this sense of, we're afraid to talk about Black people. It became very clear. And I just sort of filed that one away and thought, well, we're coming back to it at the end of the class. So I'll just file it away and see what happens as we go along. The invitation was there to look, because we had talked about the fantastic hegemonic imagination and counter-memory, and students often like those ideas, especially in a master's level. It's like, oh, this is helpful for us to think about. But helping them see, them practice it, is the thing that I don't know how to do other than when I'm in the room asking them to think about it. I don't know yet all the mechanisms in place other than this, is asking all of us to take pay close attention when somebody says to us, I'm being wronged, or my people are being wronged. That's the moment where we can begin to look and see what's going on, and not go into defensive posture, which would be our first response, especially if it's directed at us. To realize, okay, defensive posture is normal, natural, get over it. Okay, let's think through why folks are saying this, and why we're reacting as, no, that can't be. That's the moment where the imagination, I think, has captured us, so that we can't move. And that's when we need to start looking and really paying attention to what folks are saying, what they're seeing, how they're trying to point to things, and may not be able to point to things. You know, sometimes the silence is as important as the noise. But that's my hunch. It's at that moment of resistance when we hear someone say, this doesn't feel right. And we just say, okay, no, that's not right. They're not accurate. They're being sensitive, but all the kinds of ways that we react. Because it's not the big bits that trip us up. It's the everyday stuff. Looking at something like the atrocities in Gina, Louisiana, that's too easy in some ways, because the ways that the southern illegal system works, it's sort of lined up. You go, okay, but what happens, for instance? And I watched it. It often happens to me on the train. I don't know what it is about the train. Now, when you're on Amtrak, there's this little thing that you will need to show your ID. Okay? So I've just learned to listen for this, just to see if it's going to happen this time. And it actually didn't happen this time, which was nice, but it happened the last time I was on the train 2 weeks ago. I hear the conductor coming behind me, and he's taking, almost always a white male. He's taking tickets, and he's just sort of punching them and thanking people. He gets to me and says, I need to see your ID. Because invariably, I'm in the business class car, where they police you because you get freebies up there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's a nicer seat. Mm-hmm. You got an outlet near your seat. You get free non-alcoholic mm-hmm. drinks with your receipt. You pay a little more. And you ride in a little more comfort. So and I watch that, and I start to notice, okay, the people I hear him stopping are the darker skinned people. Not always black folk, but the darker skinned people. That seems so small, but think about what that's like, accumulative. And the worldview that's behind that. That's what I'm trying to get at with the way the imagination works. And so there's those moments when people are like stepping back going, this is just not right. This doesn't feel good. And if our reaction is not trying to understand and seek some sense of solidarity, because sometimes people are lying. They're making up stuff. No, that is what's the... No, there's nothing wrong except your problem. So you can't assume that it's always right. But walking into that world with them and seeing what could happen. So for me, it's that moment of, I don't want to think, That's when I find, at least, that I have to take that second look and begin to realize, I've got some assumptions here. Either about what they're saying or who they are or the worldview they're representing that may not be accurate and may be my way of holding on whatever little piece of power I've got so that I can protect myself. And that's not, for me at least, that was not how I was raised. Ideally.
Do you have a follow-up?
I do, actually. Can I push that a little bit further? Mm-hmm. Part of what I heard Lisa's question was more about what's at the core of a human person that enables us to know that something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So absent a context in which we have any history or example that would show us that there's a problem, mm-hmm. do you think or feel that there's something about us that would know that there's a problem absent other people telling us that there's a problem? Yeah, well, this is the innateness.
Yeah, I am curious. I think we learn injustice. Mm-hmm. I think we learn. We get taught that one. I'm not one of those high doctrine of sin people at all. I think this is something that we get learned, to put it colloquially, and we are taught to distrust otherness. Mm-hmm. And if we're taught to distrust otherness, I think we can be taught to stand in egalitarian relationships with each other. I get nervous about what feels like to me a slippery slope into sin, when in fact, and this is something that Eric and I did talk about, I'm more interested, I think, in developing a much more robust doctrine of creation. Because I think we have spent, certainly in ethics, I see us spending a whole lot more time on the doctrine of sin than I see, at least within Protestant thought. And this may be different within Roman Catholicism, I don't know. But among Protestants, we love the garden. We dwell in the garden. We spend volumes and volumes in the garden. And we don't look at what happens every time creation is marked. The word is good. So for me, and this is a little bit of a hobby horse I get on in class, and I know that I need to do something about it that's a little more rigorous and sustained, is I want to spend more time looking at what a robust doctrine of creation would look like for us. Because I do think we were created good. And then we drift. And if we drift one way, we can drift the other way. Innate talk makes me twitchy.
No,
I didn't hear you suggesting it, but I'm just saying, even when people suggest it, I have this internal yip. I get the yips. Don't go there. Please don't go there. Settle down. Turn the other way. Go back. So I really do think, though, as I said, that we can learn humanity as much as we can learn inhumanity. And perhaps it's little things like taking seriously Scripture and realizing that that's a tough ride, because the Bible does not speak in one voice. If you take it seriously, it contradicts itself here and there and everywhere. So that then says to me, we need to be thinking, feeling, doing responders of faith, and not the pour it in and automaton stuff that I see so much happening in so many religious communities, that it just says, like, fearless Bible study is not a bad thing. God can handle it. Can we do it? Can we engage? And I learned this sitting doing Torah with Jews. There was no question off the table. I heard questions I'd never heard in the Christian context about the same book, at least the Old Testament, I'd been reading for years. And it wasn't like considered blasphemy or any of the things that I grew up hearing. It was considered God's talking to us, and we got to understand, and maybe God got this wrong. You know, that idea, God got this wrong? I don't hear too many Christian folks talking about that. But it's not the sense of denigrating God, but really walking into what Scripture has to say to us. Now, I realize I'm talking to a Catholic crowd and what that might mean for some. But I would say make the same argument among Protestants, because I don't think we do Scripture stuff very well either. I think it's mostly add and stir, as opposed to really engaging. But since we got a common book, why not use it? And look at the ways in which that challenges us all the time to rethink how we do what we do. From things as hard for some folks to... a lot of dispossessed folk love the Exodus story. Well, the Exodus story is fine if you're not a Canaanite. Who are the Canaanites in our society? Well, you know, the first place you can go is Native Americans, but there are other Canaanites. What happens when you start looking at that story from the people who were just being? They hadn't done much. They weren't even attacking anybody. But a conquering people of faith come. How might we want to hold up on our actions about always being right because God is on our side? It's that kind of thing that... the imagination then, that pulls you back a little bit. It makes you start thinking again and again. And since I don't think anybody is really a literalist when it comes to Scripture, because I don't see people walking around with ears cut off and eyes poked out and a few other things that are supposed to happen if you do certain things. Mm-hmm. since a lot of us are big meat eaters. Where, you know, if you really took scripture seriously, we might all be vegetarians. And if not that, vegans even, like, oh my Lord. Now, I'm sorry, I like ribs, so I'm not giving that up. But it's that sense of where those places within our tradition that already ask us to use our imagination. And how can we use those places, not as the sort of matter of rote things that we often use them for, but as those prompts I think they're intended to be from God, to say, you know, look at this one more time. If my revelation is ongoing, you need to keep up with me. And you're stuck. So those are some of the places I think, you know, I don't think we're doomed to being our worst selves. I think there's more there.
Other questions on the table? Suzanne?
Well, just quickly to follow that up. We're not doomed to be in a, see, I'm coming from an evangelical Protestant background, so help me out here.
That's okay.
We're not doomed to be our worst self individually, or we're doomed to be our worst selves corporately?
It sounds like you've been reading Niebuhr and Reinhold, not H. Richard. There is a pattern in which I think Niebuhr was right. We do pretty okay as individuals, but God help us when we get in groups. But that's not always true. Even Niebuhr said that. Maybe the hope is the church, as cranky as he was about the nature of the church. I would like to think that that little band of folks in New Haven who are fighting the INS because New Haven instituted ID cards for folks who don't drive and whatever, and the INS came in and did a raid in one of the Spanish-speaking enclaves in the city, because they knew who these people were, and they assumed they were all illegal immigrants, whether they were or weren't. I've got to believe that little band of folks who are saying no and organizing the entire city, not only through the churches but through Yale, which is amazing because Yale's the big house and New Haven is the plantation. That they represent a group of folks who really believe that justice can be done. So, I think that there are groups like that all over, not just individuals, but people who are saying, this isn't right, something needs to be done. It's not just because it's people like us, it's people who aren't like us, but it's still not right. That there's those opportunities there as well. And so, as much as I believe in a strong moral individual being able to create a more strong moral society, that's my black evangelical background coming from the 1800s, popping out, so I admit it. I think that's a lens into how we can be, as it stick to our guns. A lot of us know right from wrong, and a lot of us also get in groups and lose our moral nerve. And so it's the challenge of faith, for me at least, to not do that.
I'd like to pitch in a question of my own to follow up on your last point about, in your initial talk about the role of the person as a citizen in the republic. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I'm curious if you could speak a bit about how the sense of imagination that you're speaking of relates to the civic and is somehow fostered by or contained by or misled by the identification with the nation state. Mm-hmm. And how that, what are the challenges and problems that relate to that, and perhaps the hopefulness in terms of thinking of things as a citizen of a place or a small place as opposed to a human citizen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I try to get at that very question by using Barbara Jordan, in the last chapter. And the ways in which, does everybody remember who Barbara Jordan is?
No?
Yes.
Politician?
Yes, no?
Maybe so.
Okay.
We need a background.
Yeah, I learned. She's been dead just long enough. She's off the eye of many. Barbara Jordan was a black congresswoman from Texas, and she had a history of thirst. And she really became center stage during the Watergate hearings. I'll read it to you because I love this passage in her. And I won't do it in her voice because it strains my voice when I do it. In 1974, during the Watergate hearings, she was one of the inquisitors. And this happened on primetime television in April, actually. And she says, earlier today we heard the beginning of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, We the People. It is a very eloquent beginning, but when the document was completed on the 17th of September, 1787, I was not included in that We the People. I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in We the People. Today, and this is the part everybody remembers if you've heard the clip, because they don't reproduce that preamble to this. Today I'm an inquisitor. I believe hyperbole would not be fictional and would not overstate the solemnness which I feel right now. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution. Now, Barbara Jordan had this impeccable diction. So you listened to her whether you wanted to or not. So it's like, my faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. So you hear these bell tones ringing out over primetime television. And I get goosebumps now, but I was sitting there with my folks and I was like, wow, that woman can talk. And she's got a point. And that's just the beginning. And what she did in her opening speech was give them a lesson in constitutional law about what it meant to impeach a president. And it is still one of the best statements ever done to do that. But this image she has of We the People, appealing to one of our founding documents, which is a very common strategy in black moral thought, to appeal to the Constitution, appeal to the Declaration of Independence, founding documents which I think speak to our best selves as a nation, as a reason why we should pay attention to that. And so it is that notion of we the people that I latch on to at the end to call us into some sense of accountability, because for Jordan, who was very good at not mixing politics with her own Baptist upbringing, she was a practicing Baptist her entire life, she was raised in a Baptist family, a Baptist preacher, you don't get any more Baptist than Barbara Jordan, but she knew that it was important to think larger. And so this is not the first time she appeals to this notion of we the people in her writings and in her work, as a way to call us into a sense of more than our individual or enclavish ways of being in our society. And so that for me is, that's, when I think of we the people, my imagination just takes off. Mm-hmm. What would it mean if we really lived into this notion of we the people? Not as a nice rhetorical flourish, but as something we work towards morning by morning and day by day, to use a phrase from Katie Cannon again. But that sense of the groundedness that our imagination can actually provide for us as we try to think through, then, as people of faith, what do we bring to that? this notion of we the people. First thing to do is we do a critique of our churches, but that's another, you put that aside for a little bit, but then also recognize that there is a lot within the Christian tradition that points us to we the people that we don't access. We like to do peculiar readings of the tradition that justify our own peculiar places. So, as a Baptist, I'm on the downside of the Radical Reformation. So it's like, here's looking at you from that undertow, the way Baptists were treated within that history. But it's that sense of really trying to move into allowing that side of us that some of us don't have as developed as others of us into something that is both rational but sparks the imagination, I hope.
It's a very hopeful view of the nation as a moral community, mm-hmm. in that document as a statement of what we could be. Mm-hmm. I think I share that, but it's interesting.
I live in hope. I'm an unabashed person. I'm unabashed about living in hope. I couldn't survive if I didn't, literally. Not as an intellectual and not as a person. This recalls a conversation I had with James Cone years ago when I was finishing Breaking the Fine Rain of Death, which is a book on black health care in the U.S., or lack of it. Jim is a health nut. I mean, he runs 5 miles every day the good Lord sends, and he doesn't go out to eat because he doesn't know what they're putting in his food. He really wants to control. He wants to know what's in, he doesn't look like he's 70 as a result of that. Actually, maybe a little more than 70 now, I don't know. But I was still teaching in Kansas City, and he knew I was working on this book, and I was stuck on the last chapter, and the last chapter is on hope. And so Jim came out to do a lecture at my school, St. Paul School of Theology, which is a United Methodist school. And I picked him up, and we were driving across the Missouri landscape, and he's asking about the book. And I said, Jim, I'm stuck on the last chapter. All the stuff I know about black health care is just, it's heartbreaking. And I can't figure out why I still have hope. And Jim reared up in his Jim Cone voice. He's a tenor. Most people think he's a baritone. He's a tenor. He went, Emily, you've got to have hope. You have to have hope because the only alternative is despair, and then they won. And I was like, oh, you're right. And I sat down and wrote the last chapter in a couple weeks because he was right. I don't live in despair. I can't, because they have won, if that's the case. The forces of injustice and indecency and lack of faith have won. And I wasn't raised that way. I don't think that way. I don't process that way. It's a realistic hope. I know I'm going to lose from time to time, but that's not the point. The point is the struggle.
Can I just ask something in relationship to that about your views about the possibilities of humanity, sometimes there being evolution, but that there's an evolutionary process and a spiritual process is taking place. So in terms of hope. Mm-hmm. So it isn't just a question of that they've won, but that in fact that we're in an evolutionary process, and this is part of the learning that we have as a collective humanity.
Yeah, I use the word revelatory.
Okay.
But yes, it's simple. Similar. I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, we have time for one more question.
It goes quickly.
It does go quickly.
Especially when I give long answers.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Just a general question. I was really interested in your use of empire. Mm-hmm. And there's a trend in biblical scholarship, in theological scholarship, to use empire and mm-hmm. analyze the way mm-hmm. that empire impacts and mm-hmm. impinges upon mm-hmm. The way we read texts or the way we construct symbols. Mm-hmm. But with the exception of maybe Gary Dorian and yourself, mm-hmm. I see very little analysis of empire in relationship to ethics. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to maybe hear from you how useful this construct of empire has been in terms of thinking ethically and how it's impacted and impinged on the construction.
Actually, I got into empire. I'll tell you how the chapter on empire emerged, because I wasn't going to talk about empire. I had, because there's a part of me, that finds the kinds of conversation about empire too facile and too simplistic. And so I decided that I wanted to approach it from another angle. And this was also a lecture I had been asked to participate, or Pam and I had asked to participate in. And I realized as I was sort of casting them out, I'd read Hart and Negri and found them wanting. And teaching them in the class of master's level students is fascinating, because they have to, they eat them for lunch, because these are folks, by and large, when I first started teaching the book, who are going to be ministers somewhere, and they're going, this does not look like, this is not helpful for real people that I got to work with, because it's too theoretical and it's not grounded. How are you going to get the multitude anywhere to do anything? What's the impetus? So it was a great question, and I didn't have an answer for it. And neither did Hart and Negri. So I was already a little, they're helpful, but to a point. One day, as I was trying to figure out, how am I going to get at this without just saying, I think empire sucks, which is a very short, but erudite, ethical point, it popped, and this is something, I don't quite understand how this works sometimes, but it popped in my head. Look at the notion of 40 acres and a mule. That promise, alleged promise, that blacks received in the post-Civil War years, or just as the Civil War was winding down. And so I started looking, we started researching, and one found out there's no such thing as, the mule wasn't in the original command order, field order 15, I believe it is. Nobody really signed on to it. And it was never fully implemented, and it was withdrawn before it could have an effect. And I started, it's like, first of all, it was, what, there is no mule? That was the first thing, I had to get past the mule not being there. But also, in looking at the conversation the general had with a representative from a black church about negotiating this field order, why did they choose representatives of black church? And when you look at the transcript, it takes great pains to write down whether they're free or not, if they bought their freedom or it was granted by their master or mistress, if they owned the church property or not. There's this whole world of property relationships emerging about not only these men as property, but the church as property. And then and they're validated based on coming out on the right side of the equation, having enough property to be able to engage in this conversation. That's when I realized I could engage empire, because that's empire writ small. The kinds of effects where we are stamped as property and commodity, and therefore judged by whether or not we're talkable to or not, to negotiate the future of millions, in effect. So for me, then, it became wedding notions of empire with Christian triumphalism. And I think you see Gary doing a similar sort of thing, although he's going in another direction, but we're both concerned with the way that Christian triumphalism feeds empire in this country. Because if you think you're the right one, and God has told you to go forth and conquer, which is exactly what we heard in justifying the war in Iraq, and all manner of wars before that one, where darker-skinned people are being conquered by the U.S., Philippines, it goes on and on. Mexico, I mean, it just goes on and on. Then who's going to stop you if you say God's on your side? Who's going to get on the bad side of God who's got good sense? And that's what Christian triumphalism does. It becomes the engine, along with exceptionalism on the political side, that fuels attempts to conquer and writ large our cultures into other cultures, which for me is what empire is about. It's a thing, it happens, it has its way. I work in Brazil every summer, and every summer I watch the effect of U.S. empire on the Brazilian economy, the Brazilian people, Brazilian culture. The summer I was there, I'm blanking on who was Secretary of the Treasury at that time. But he made an offhanded remark about the U.S. economy, and, you know, going into a tailspin and a default, which was a joke. It was not a joke in Brazil. Within hours of that joke, I watched prices shoot up. Just everyday items going to the market. And I said, what happened? Because I hadn't heard about this. And people said, didn't you hear what your country said again? Oh, God, what did our country say again? And so I found the article, went online and found the article, and went, oh my God, that was a joke. He wasn't kidding. It wasn't funny. That's empire. When a joke can be treated as a fact and then have a profound effect on a country's economy. It took the rest of the summer for the Brazilian economy to settle down when it realized that the U.S. was not going in the tank. Now we are kind of going in the tank, but, you know, it's now a slow ride there, so they're able to adjust. So it was, for me, a real tangible example. Empire exists, where even our jokes, that we know are jokes here, are not translated as such in other places, in other nations. And it has a profound and lasting effect, because in Brazil there's almost no middle class left. It's a very, very small segment of the population. So you're either wealthy or you're working like hell, just trying to make it. So there's not that buffer we have here of the middle class when something like this happens. So,
yeah. Well, from one joke by a Secretary of State, we won't joke when we say thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate it. It's a terrific, terrific talk. Thank you. And I know you've got other stuff to go to as well, but we can figure out if you want to linger and walk her down, and I can go down with you as well. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you. That's a nice day.